but not enough for Venezuela to survive. If the U.S. stop playing this game, because at the end of the day, the U.S. is indebted to $33 trillion, but it is in dollars. They can print it any time, okay, and they don't care, really. So sure, at the end of the day, their devastating policy and destructive, okay, policy is one of the major causes of what's happening in the world.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're just fresh out of time, but thank you. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, Clive Menzies, as a pleasure, researcher and political economy analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Vitahoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed, and He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lines a number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank since the start of the year rises to 9. More than 70,000 staff at 150 universities across the UK go on strike. And the U.S. Justice Department announces the appointment of a special counsel to investigate President Biden's handling of documents. Joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Palestinian Health Ministry says another youth has succumbed to injuries sustained during an Israeli raid near the West Bank city of Jenin. 18-year-old Abdul Hadi Fahri Nazal has been hit in the chest and the neck by Israeli forces live fire in the town of Qabtia. He was taken to hospital in critical condition. Nazal was the second casualty of Israeli forces' assault on Qabtia to arrest Palestinian fighters. Earlier, the 25-year-old Habib Mohammed Ikma died of wounds sustained from Israeli forces' gunfire. The new fatalities came after Israeli troops killed 41-year-old Samir Aslan during an overnight raid in Qalandia refugee camp in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli soldiers have killed 9 Palestinians since the start of the year, including 3 minors.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil on Wednesday. 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Iran's foreign minister says his country will continue to support the Lebanese people, government and resistance with full force. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks upon his arrival in the Lebanese capital for an official visit. He urged all political groups in Lebanon to elect the country's president through dialogue and agreement. Amir Abdullahian added that political groups in Lebanon are able to choose a president without any foreign intervention. Iran's top diplomat is scheduled to meet with his Lebanese counterpart and the country's prime minister and parliament speaker during his visit. In our news review program, we discussed in detail the latest remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the recent developments in the country.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemies made miscalculations when hatching plots to fuel the recent riots and to create disruption in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the enemies tapped into all of their available resources to plunge the country into chaos and turmoil. He said that they cashed in on people's livelihood issue as the country's economic situation was not very good. The leader added, among other techniques the enemies employed to stoke unrest were to sneak espionage teams into Iran, to promote Iranophobia worldwide through various propaganda ploys, and to incite ethnic, religious, political, and even personal sentiments. However, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that they failed to pull it off despite all of their schemes because of their miscalculations and Iran's firm resolve. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with eulogists. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. Muhammad Ali Araka is also a journalist and political analyst, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'll first start with you. I think it's noteworthy to put into an approach to this question as to the fact that Iran's leader says the enemy put everything they had in terms of any avenue that they felt that should be channeled in order to, go for their ultimate goal, which I'm guessing would be obviously for a change in the Islamic Republic system, but they failed. Isn't that one way of looking first at what Iran's leader has said?
I think it's fairly evident they failed. Of course, there was a huge occasion, and what their cyber warfare techniques. They used every terrorism technique with all their proxy terrorists surrounding Iran and both internally within Iran as well. They've obviously upped the ante in terms of the economic maximum pressure scenario, which has been going on for, well, decades now. But of course, all of this has failed. The efforts this time, though, were particularly focused, I think, on also using some of the what I call the cultural psychological operations. I think they rather hope that the Iranian youth, the Iranian public, will rebel against the establishment because they prefer what we could only describe as Westoxified morality, Westoxified social and cultural agendas.
Taking a look at some of the channels that were used, Muhammad Ali Araki, do you believe that the way that this was devised was not to use just one, but to use all different avenues, as I mentioned in my first question, which would include the media, which would include the youth, the cultural aspect, throw in the espionage services of different countries, have an international campaign to vilify Iran, which overall is under the Iranophobia umbrella, all at once, with the hopes that this would obviously go for the aim of toppling, perhaps, the government. Which one of these do you think was either ranking high, and overall, why did it fail?
I believe that generally they planned it differently this time. So they had the economical side, the cultural side, and they also had the youth in, and they wanted to get the youth out against, especially the religious scholars. This was something that went on in Iran for a period of time. But I do agree with the fact that the Mahsa Amini events that occurred, it was something completely different. But as usual, they failed, and I expect the same to happen. If they attempt to do anything in the future, they will fail again.
Well, that's the whole thing. The idea of how to move forward on the same Mohsen Abbas is, of course, we can't continue this conversation without at least being mentioned how vigilant the security forces and besieged paramilitary forces have actually gone out and put their lives on the line to make sure that law and order is maintained, even though many of them have been killed. I believe there's over 80 at this point, or 82. I'm not sure about the exact amount, but kudos to them, and really hats off to them for putting their lives on the line. But at the same time, do you think that this pressure tactic that the West in general has gone after is going to continue? And what kind of role would Israel play in this whole thing? Because we know what they are after.
I think it is all about Israel. And the bottom line is that the Zionist lobby in Congress, the Zionist lobby, which has a hold on the Anglo-Zionist Imperial Alliance as a whole, dictates the terms and conditions of all the foreign policy, whether it's for Britain, America, or most of the EU now. So I'm afraid Iran has to stay braced for an ongoing, attack on their sovereignty. They have to stay embraced for the fact that the imperialism and the hegemony agenda, which the Americans have enjoyed across the Middle East, will continue. They have to also embrace the fact that their neighbors, who are puppets, the leaders at least, of their neighboring nations, like Saudi Arabia and others, Jordan, Egypt, all of those players in the West Asia arena who are essentially puppets of America and Israel, they will continue to also play a part, because it's from their territories, the territories even in northern Iraq, where the Kurds are again proxies and puppets of Israeli Americans, as well as the Azerbaijanis, as well as Afghanistan. All of these regions have they have terrorist organizations or operatives which are ready to try to infiltrate Iran, and I'm afraid that is going to continue. The foreseeable future looks at a complete collapse in any of those negotiations regarding the JCPOA and the efforts by the Americans and the Israelis to basically stop Iran from having any access to nuclear development and progress in that region. It will also jeopardize, of course, Iran's economics. And Iran has, of course, the more it's been put under pressure, the more Iran has learned to create what I describe as a resistance economy. So the ability to create its own manufacturing industries, the ability to reach out to the East and the Eurasian axis, the ability to be able to become part of the Shanghai Corporation, Cooperation or the BRICS alliance, the ability to also reject the dollar and to dump the SWIFT mechanism of engaging in finance around the world. All okay. these things are now inevitable. They're happening, and more of these things will obviously emerge. And the result will be that America's hold in that region will increasingly decrease.
Thank you. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Say Mohsen Abbas. Many thanks, journalist and political commentator. Mohamed Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
More than the 70,000 staff at 150 British universities will go on strike in disputes over pay, working conditions, and pensions. The new industrial action comes as the UK witnesses a wave of strikes across the sectors, from healthcare to railways. According to the University and College Union, the strike will continue for 18 days between February and March. The union represents academics and other professional staff in Britain's colleges and universities. It demands a pay rise higher than the 3% that its members have received. The union says pay rises awarded for the last decade have all been below the inflation rate. The union's general secretary says the sector does not reach a deal with its members there and will be widespread disruptions through spring. Different British government departments and public sector bodies have been hit with strikes over the last month as pay rises failed to keep pace with double-digit inflation. In France, unions are mobilizing to strike after the government of President Macron announced a controversial pension reform plan. The strikes and demonstrations are set to kick off on the 19th of January. The government says that it will stand its ground, but unions say they will fight to reverse the controversial plan.
French trade unions call for strikes and protests over President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms. The strikes are set to be held on January 19th. It's not yet clear how many people will join the strikes and which services will be affected. It will be the first time in 12 years since the last pension changes that all of France's unions are united. The head of the more moderate CFDT, Laurent Berger, has called the reform one of the most brutal of the last 30 years. Opinion polls show that around two-thirds of French people oppose the proposed reforms. The socialists, the hard-left France Unbowed, and far-right National Rally were quick to say they would oppose the reform. Some ruling party lawmakers have spoken privately of their concern about the protests, while one of the allies of President Macron has warned that the government has not explained itself sufficiently. The calls for pension reforms comes amid high inflation and with the country still recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic.
The U.S. president is facing a fresh scrutiny as a second batch of documents marked as classified has been discovered in a new location.
We're cooperating fully and completely with the Justice Department's review. As part of that process, my lawyer has reviewed other places where documents from my time as vice president were stored, and they finished the review last night. They discovered a small number of documents of classified markings in storage areas and file cabinets in my home and my personal library.
Biden's attorneys found the documents in a storage at the garage of his home in Delaware. The admission comes only 2 days after other classified records were found at Biden's former office of a think tank based at the University of Pennsylvania. Biden said that he did not know about those files and was taken by surprise. The U.S. Justice Department has announced the appointment of a special counsel to investigate Biden's handling of sensitive government documents. The discoveries have presented legal and political headaches as the president prepares for a 2024 re-election campaign in the coming months. Meanwhile, the U.S. House Speaker has called for a congressional investigation of Biden's after the new revelation. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, paragon of virtue for all women. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on a very auspicious day. Today, the 20th of the month of Jamadi Uthani, is celebrated as Mother's Day in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well as in countries and societies where women and motherhood are viewed from the standpoint of virtue with respect attached to them as the basic builders of sound and healthy societies. This is in sharp contrast to the decadent Western culture, which considers women as carnal and commercial commodities. Islam has designated a lofty position for the daughters of Eve. It has placed emphasis on morally upright ladies from the beginning of creation, such as Sarah, the wife of Prophet Abraham, Mary, the mother of Prophet Jesus, Hazrat Khadija, the wife of the Prophet of Islam, and the noblest of them all, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, whose birthday we are celebrating today. Dear listeners, please stay with us for a special feature on this most exemplary lady, the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Paradise lies at the feet of the mother, says a famous statement from the Prophet of Islam in order to emphasize the mother's lofty and dignified position in Islam. As is evident by the words of God Almighty in the Noble Quran, the mother, along with the father, deserves the highest respect from the children, to the extent that Ayah 32 of Surah Maryam has preserved the words of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him. And God has commanded me to be good to my mother. Thus, if the last and greatest prophet hails his lone daughter and only surviving child as Umm Abiha, or mother of her own father, then what would be the position in the whole universe of that lady whom God himself has called Kawthar, or the perennial spring of abundant munificence in the Noble Quran with those immortal worlds? Indeed, we have granted you Kawthar, so pray to your Lord and offer sacrifice. Indeed, it is your enemy who is without posterity. This is the most expressive statement which can be used for describing the lady who embodied all feminine virtues and could indeed be called a wonder of God's creation in view of her position par excellence that makes her the greatest lady of all times from the beginning till the end. Now we understand why the Islamic Republic of Iran has designated the blessed 20th of Jamadi Uthani, the auspicious birth anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, as a Mother's Day and Women's Week for Iran and for countries or communities striving to uplift their societies through proper values for grooming devout daughters, virtuous wives, and model mothers. The paragon par excellence of feminine merits is the one and only flawless Fatima, peace upon her. In other words, no ordinary woman or an insignificant day the UN has chosen to supposedly honor mothers and women without taking into consideration such values as virtue, ethical perfection, chastity, and feminine dignity could be considered as Mother's Day. Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, needs no introduction. Thanks to the lofty status of the Prophet's peerless daughter, the immaculate wife of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, and the exemplary mother of four impeccable children, sons Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and daughters Hazrat Zainab and Hazrat Umm Kulthum, peace upon them, all negative notions regarding daughters were changed for good. She is the daughter of a family whose sons died in infancy in a society that derided girls and considered boys as heirs. For this reason, being a girl was considered a form of disgrace in not just the society of ignorance of Arabia, but also among the supposedly civilized nations of those days. In the days when women were treated as no more than chattel of possessions of men, God Almighty decided to bestow honor on women by granting his greatest prophets a gem of a daughter, through whom his name will shine brighter than any supernova, when the lineal descents of those priding on male issue will be cast into oblivion. In fact, so humiliating had become the situation of women in the pre-Islamic society of Arabia that some Arabs used to bury their daughters alive in fear of the shame she would bring on the family when she grows up. The Noble Quran informs us in Surah Nahl, Ayah 58, when one of them is brought the news of a female newborn, his face becomes darkened and he chokes with suppressed agony. This explicit statement of God Almighty is a denouncement of the ignorance of mankind and the mistreatment of women, who ought to be respected for their virtue and chastity and should not be exploited as a commercial and carnal commodity, which women have unfortunately become in the modern-day Western society, similar to their sordid situation in the pre-Islamic Arabia. God Almighty thus revolutionized the situation of women by decreeing the death in infancy of the Prophet's sons and then granting him an impeccable daughter in order to serve as the finest example of virtue for women of all times. Religion could be broadly divided into two categories, that is, wisdom and affection. In other words, if wisdom lights the path of guidance, affection is the engine that provides energy to believers to act and move. The finest example of the harmonious blending of these two important factors is the life of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. She played a pivotal role in the household. She was a little girl when her mother, mother of all true believers, Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, passed away. Yet little Fatima, peace upon her, so dedicatedly took care of her widowed father that she earned the epithet of Umm Abiha, or mother of her father. This concept and this demonstration of fatherly and daughterly love went on to revolutionize society. When she grew up, the Prophet, on divine commandment, married her to his virtuous cousin, the young and energetic Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. The two made an excellent pair and showed to the world how a husband and wife should lead an exemplary life and raise worthy children. Only a wall separated the house of the Prophet and his daughter, and these were the only houses whose doors opened into the courtyard of the Prophet's mosque in Medina. It was the habit of the Prophet to salute his daughter every morning at the time of the Fajr or early dawn prayer. He used to stand to his feet whenever his immaculate daughter entered his presence, and in order to show her prime position, he would make her sit on his own place. She was the last person whom the Prophet would bid farewell when leaving Medina and the first person he would greet on arrival from his journey. In Islam, there is no distinction between males and females regarding their rights, personal merits, and pursuit of knowledge. In fact, the Prophet has emphasized that women should learn and acquire knowledge. Islam thus gave women the right to education, own property, and chose the spouse. It also granted them the dignity of hijab, which signifies freedom and liberty in the real sense of these terms, thereby earning respect in society and giving meaning to life. As the other half of mankind, it is the virtuous wife who, in addition to providing peace and solace to her husband, plays the fundamental role of mother in building a sound and healthy society by bringing up children in the proper manner on the basis of faith and moral values. These factors rule out immorality and with it, any agonizing thoughts for parents. The finest example of these feminine virtues is without doubt Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. She was blessed with divine wisdom as she acquired knowledge from the celestial fountain of prophethood to become the embodiment of truth. She considered the harmonious environment of the home to be very important for the proper growth of children. It was an honor for her to be a woman who would set the lasting example for all daughters of Eve. She raised exemplary children. She used to encourage her sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, to attend the mosque and hear the sermons of their grandfather, the Prophet. Besides performing the rites of worship in the correct manner, assisted by their father, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. When she used to supplicate to God Almighty, she would first pray for all the community and then lastly for herself and her family, saying, "The neighbors take precedence over the household." What a selfless attitude indeed in the divine court for which God Almighty rewarded her with manifold merits. Among her merits is her central position in the revelation of Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab to the prophets in her house regarding the pristine purity of his immediate family, the Ahlul Bayt, that is, his daughter, son-in-law, and two grandsons. Indeed, Allah desires to keep away uncleanness from you, the Ahlul Bayt, and preserve you thoroughly purified. It also worth noting that the entry of this specific group of five fabulous persons ensured the victory of the truth of Islam on the field of the historic Mubahale with the Christians of Najran. It bears testimony to the fact that no other woman except the Prophet's daughter is mentioned in this particular ayah, which is number 61 of Surah Al-Imran, that commands the Prophet to take along with him for the unique challenge with the Christians. Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, thus embodies the essence of the immortal spirit of Islam as we celebrate her birth anniversary as Mother's Day. She is not just the mother of four virtuous children, but through her younger son, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, she is the ancestress of nine infallible imams, the last of whom is the Prophet's 12th divinely designated successor, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who will reappear in the end times to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Here I am about to leave my dark cell in which I learned not to be afraid of the dark, nor to feel alienated or lonely because I am among my brothers. With these words, Palestinian liberated detainee Karim Yunus chose to send a final message to the Palestinian people slightly before the end of his 40 years long incarceration inside Israeli occupation prisons. 40 long years Karim spent behind Zionist bars, during which he lost both his parents. The Palestinian arena for which he fought witnessed many changes during this period, starting from the First Intifada to the Second, up to the multiple aggressions on Gaza and the resistance responses to it. Karim Yunus, the dean of the Palestinian prisoners, practiced his life as a Palestinian fighter inside the prisons of the occupation. The testimonies of the liberated prisoners about him were filled with expressions of his influence on the morale of the prisoners, supporting their steadfastness and permanently preserving the flame of their enthusiasm and patience. Karim continued his education while inside the detention center and did not allow the prison cells to extinguish the spark of his ideas. He even personally supervised advanced university education for a number of prisoners. He was not satisfied with keeping to himself inside the prison, but rather made himself a complete vital field that radiated with energy. From Hadarim prison, the son of the town of Ara in northern occupied Palestine left his comrades on January 5, 2023, on board a civilian car. And after he was transported in three cars throughout the journey of surprise and misleading to thwart his reception ceremony, prepared in advance by his family to celebrate his freedom, the secret security operation, as Karim describes it, ended with him being left alone near a bus station in the town of Tabsir, which is a one-hour drive from his hometown where his family awaited him. The man of steel decided at that time not to use the bus card that the Shin Bet soldiers gave him in order to return to his hometown alone. There, the 62-year-old free man met some Palestinian workers, asked them about the name of the area, borrowed one of their phones, and informed his two brothers, who were waiting for him in front of the prison gate, of his whereabouts. His first visit was to his mother's burial site. The gentle legend fell in front of his mother's grave, who passed away only 7 months ago today. "She chose to see me free from heaven," Karim gently said, before speaking extensively about her visiting him 700 times over the course of 39 and a half years since his arrest on the 5th of January, 1983. After his liberation, the occupation tried hard to suffocate the joy of the Palestinians in general and the joy of his family in particular. However, his family and the people of his town broke the restrictions of the occupation, flaunting their celebration of Karim's freedom after 40 long years. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Many will strive to calculate the duration of his sentence in days, minutes, and seconds, while trimming the hair of his bald head and his slow but calm steps. But for Karim Yunus, what matters is that he is finally free. At exactly 5:40 a.m. on January 5, Israeli occupation soldiers entered his cell. They told him he was going out. He insisted that he takes a shower and puts on his best clothes before meeting for the last time with the officers of the prison administration, who would strive to spoil his joy, telling him it is forbidden to celebrate, it is forbidden to receive well-wishers, it is forbidden to raise the Palestinian flags, which Karim responded, "The decision is not mine, but rather it is that of my family, my friends, and my people." To discuss this issue with us from occupied Al-Quds is Dr. Mohammad Halasay, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Mohammad. Now, the exact words of Karim when he first spoke to reporters after he was liberated from his 40 years sentence in Zionist occupation were, "I don't feel anything at moment. There's nothing inside me that I feel or what I can express. Today, I breathed the air, I saw the sunlight, I might get used to that in the coming days." This is what he told reporters. This is definitely post-human rights violation syndrome due to the 40 years of incarceration and God knows what kind of torture he witnessed. I mean, with all those NGOs and the UN resolutions and whatnot all over the world, why is that the voices of the Palestinian detainees still unheard?
I believe the issue of the Palestinian detainees inside Zionist prisons is the most sensitive cause directly after the issue of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is the cause that has the most potential to stir the Palestinian streets and that attracts broader sympathy in the Palestinian arena. Throughout the Palestinian national struggle, the Palestinian action factions went through many trials in attempt to swap Palestinian prisoners for either Israeli soldiers or Israeli settlers. Some of these attempts were successful, leading to the liberation of many of these detainees, the last of which was the Shalit deal that led to freeing many Palestinian detainees. Also, there were many agreements made between the Palestinian Authority and the Zionist Authority that also led to the liberation of some of our prisoners. This prime cause comes along many other high-priority causes that the Palestinian people struggles with against this colonial power. Struggles like the illegal settlements building, the Al-Quds issue and the Al-Aqsa issue and the broader demarcation issue as well. The Palestinian people engage in wide confrontations at all fronts, and the Palestinian detainees' cause is just one of these fronts. We strive hard as a Palestinian society, factions and institutions to make their voices heard globally at all levels. However, as you know, the world we live in is a hypocrite world, an unjust world that gives no weight whatsoever for human rights. On the contrary, the world only cares about political interests, especially when it comes to Israel, which is an entity above international law. The international community even deals with Israel as a state that is above the law. Many Palestinian demands and grievances are ignored by Israel and do not find an echo in the various international institutions.
Well, Dr. Mohammad Karim, the Palestinian hero who regained his freedom, he was arrested after carrying out a heroic operation that led to the death of one Israeli occupation soldier and wounding many others. And he was one of the fiercest fighters of the Fatah movement during that time. And he showed solid and confident rhetoric while he was inside prison and on the first day that he regained his freedom as well. How do you think this rhetoric works out with the young Palestinian youth who are still struggling under this occupation?
This long life of giving while being incarcerated inside the Zionist prison and then coming out from behind bars with this high spirit and morale is a model and an example. It is a unique case of confronting the occupation, because we as a Palestinian people depend on this spirit and our Palestinian youth depend on this spirit. As it is well known that the Palestinian cause is neither a social nor an economic issue. It is a national struggle issue and a people's freedom issue. This cause deserves from us, our youth and our Palestinian society, to spend all that we've got for its liberation. Therefore, we find that the first words of the liberated detainee, Karim, after his release from captivity were that if he had the opportunity to return and spend another 40 years for this cause, he would not have retreated or hesitated. The spirit of giving, which our noble youth are charged with, is one of the most important aspects of this liberation. This occupation is a rogue and aggressive occupation that does not value human dignity. Karim has preceded other great models of giving and sacrificing for this cause. Karim was preceded by great sacrifices made by many Palestinian youth and by Palestinian military and political leaders for the freedom of our Palestinian people. Karim represents a defiant model of resistance, representing the unbreakable Palestinian vigor that emerges in full force after 40 years. Just counting these 40 years in numbers tires the soul, let alone that a person should live them and endure the conditions that Karim went through and many of our prisoners in the occupation prisons are still going through. This is certainly a charging message and a message of example to our Palestinian youth who are enlightened by Karim and the likes of Karim in his path to the continuation of liberation, freedom and eliminating this occupation.
Well, Dr. Mohammed, let's say what was interesting, because it didn't happen the first time, it happened many times before, but possibly it's happening maybe the first time with the presence of social media, that the occupation forces stormed the house of Karim's family one night before Karim gained his freedom, and they raided his house in the town of Ara. They went inside the occupied interior territories, they seized all the Palestinian flags, and they told the family that they are banned from raising any Palestinian flag, any photo that resembles anything that has to do with the Palestinian cause, basically any kind of patriotic music to celebrate the freedom of Karim. What are the Israelis truly afraid of in the 1948 occupied Palestinian territories? Are they afraid of joy?
Especially when it comes as a joy of victory for a prisoner who came out of prison with his head held high, full of energy and vigor. This occupation exerted all its efforts over all the years of its occupation of the Palestinian lands in the lands of 1948 to strip the Palestinian society and isolate it from its national extension in the West Bank and Gaza. Many attempts were made by this occupation to obscure the Palestinian national identity and to try to capture and Judaize the Palestinian community. Efforts were made at the level of fragmentation of Palestinian society at home by pumping weapons and drugs, supporting gangs within Palestinian societies and not fighting them. All of these aimed at fragmenting the Palestinian society in the occupied territory. This joy today angers the Zionists because long years of work to strike the Palestinian national identity in the occupied interior did not bear fruit. Look at all these young men and women who did not live in a revolution, a national state, or a state of liberation in the occupied interior. Look at them today raising the Palestinian flag. It is raised by the elderly in addition to the youth and children. This confirms that the Palestinian people inside the occupied interior are still linked to their identity, history and struggle, and they are still fighting. In a contradictory picture as well, this Israeli society and this Israeli government, which is trying to strip the Palestinian society of the interior from its identity, treads with superiority and does not even tolerate the participation of these people in the political system within the occupation entity. We saw that an Israeli government in which the Arabs participated did not last for more than a year, and that a very large part of the Israeli society is not satisfied with the participation of the Arabs in their government. So they do not want them to be Palestinians and do not even accept their participation in the Israeli political system. This is the nature of the occupation, this racist, arrogant and supranational society that does not see the Palestinian human and does not accept his existence and seeks, if given the opportunity, to expel him outside the borders of the Palestinian map.
Dr. Mohammed Halasay, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs, I want to thank you very much for joining us from the occupied Al-Quds, the eternal capital of the Palestinian state, and congratulations to you and all the Palestinian communities all across the world, not only in Palestine, for the liberation of the dean of detainees of Palestinian prisoners from the Israeli Zionist jails. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking how Yemen is between peace and war.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Ministream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The situation in Yemen continues to fluctuate between peace and war, a situation in which Sana'a recently announced clearly and repeatedly that it would not accept it becoming a fait accompli, vowing to put an end to it quickly. Sana'a vowed to decide the direction of matters either to peace that meets its conditions or to war that enables it to impose these same conditions. More in this following report.
While the status quo continues to rule the scene in Yemen, as the options of military escalation and a peaceful settlement proceed at a similar pace of speed and appropriate conditions for both, the leadership of Ansarullah was keen to stress that the Yemeni government in Sana'a will not accept more evasion and killing time at the expense of the rights and suffering of the Yemeni people. Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi's warnings came during his meeting with the Omani delegation that had recently visited Sana'a, where he made it clear to his guests that the Yemeni people will not starve anymore, stressing that Ansarullah will use all their capabilities to lift the siege on the Yemeni people so they can benefit from their resources and wealth. In this context, relevant sources in Sana'a say that in parallel with Sayyid Houthi's clear messages of aims, the concerned military forces were given a signal of full readiness, revealing that some moves in the context of this readiness were deliberately shown in order to be monitored by the enemy, so the latter knows that the Yemeni armed forces are serious and that they do not issue hollow threats. The same source who wished to remain anonymous confirmed to Press TV that this time, if there is no satisfactory response to the Yemeni humanitarian demands, as things will head towards escalation, the battle will be qualitative and will include all arenas, namely the Red Sea, Bab al-Mandeb Strait, and Aramco in the Saudi depth as well as the Emirati depth. The ball is now in the Saudi court. Sana'a believes that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has the answer to many questions. Today, Yemen, after the aggression, stands as a major obstacle to the development of bin Salman's project to transform Saudi Arabia into a global trade center, in addition to the fact that all Saudi leaders have come to the conviction that they can no longer subjugate Yemen, recognizing that this country has become outside its orbit, especially in light of the map of forces produced by 8 years of war. The features of that conviction appeared clearly in the ongoing negotiations on extending the armistice. Sana'a had already raised four main issues in the face of Riyadh, namely lifting the blockade, non-interference in Yemeni internal affairs, paying compensation, and retreating from Yemeni land. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia demanded guarantees that Yemen would not pose a threat to Saudi Arabia and its security. The kingdom had already raised the issue of guarantees before Sultanate of Oman as a mediator, the latter which then noted that Ansarullah has expressed its willingness to dispel Riyadh's security concerns if this helps it reach a decisive decision to abide by what has been grasped in the negotiations regarding a comprehensive and final solution to the unnecessary and illegal war on Yemen. Now, at the moment, the American factor becomes more influential on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden seeks with all its might to keep the state of no war and no peace prevailing, as firstly, it benefits financially from the situation, and secondly, desires Yemen to remain an extorting card in the tension between Biden and bin Salman.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Talib al-Hassani, political analyst and media persona on the Yemeni Al-Masira TV. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Talib. Now, Saudi leaders have come to the conviction that they can no longer subjugate Yemen, recognizing that Yemen has become outside the kingdom's orbit, especially in light of the map of Yemeni forces that came to light after the eight-year war of Saudi Arabia's unnecessary war and illegitimate war against Yemen. What would be the perfect way for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman out of this war while saving face?
No doubt that Saudi Arabia, since 2019 in specific, has begun negotiations in order to find a way out of this war while saving face. However, it is hard for them to exit in such a way out of this war that lasted 8 years, a war that cannot in any way save face for Mohammed bin Salman. Saudi Arabia wants two types of endings for this war. First, it seeks an undisclosed secret deal with Yemen. This is what the Saudis have been working to achieve since 2019 when they made way for a secret table of negotiations in Oman that with time turned into an openly disclosed negotiations due to mutual leaking of points of discussions to the media. The Saudis want a secret deal that would lead the Yemenis to stop attacking Saudi Arabia in return for the Saudis to halt all air operations against Yemen and to stop funding its mercenaries inside Yemen, while partially lifting the siege against the Yemeni population. In return, Saudis might allow a Yemeni-Yemeni peace talk. However, Yemen completely disapproves of this plan because this would automatically take the Saudis out of the eye of the political and military storm. We all know that the war against Yemen includes Saudi Arabia and many other countries. However, the military bases are inside Saudi Arabia. Those who carry out military operations are of Saudi nationality and of European and American nationalities, and even Israelis at some point. They even have military bases in Ethiopia and Eritrea on the Red Sea. Hence, this is a regional international war against Yemen, which is why Yemen refuses the Saudi description of the war as a civil war in Yemen and refuses any secret deals.
Either way, whether it is secretive or not, Sana'a did raise four basic addresses in the face of Riyadh, which announced its initial approval to these four basic addresses, being that Saudi Arabia will have to lift the blockade, they will have to have non-interference in Yemeni internal affairs, they will have to pay compensation for Yemen and to leave basically Yemeni land that they are occupying. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia demanded guarantees from Yemen that they would not pose a threat to Saudi Arabia and to the economy and security of Saudi Arabia. Then what actually is Saudi Arabia going to gain from all this war?
Naturally, Saudi Arabia will not be immune from the aftermath of the war. Saudi Arabia lost control over the